This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
This is Drew Tignanelli here with Money, Riches, and Wealth. And Bon Bon is here tonight.
Yes, sir.
Tommaso, how are you?
I'm doing great.
You're headed to Florida.
Yep. Little trip down south.
2 weeks away. You know, this is the time of year that it's so hot down there, everybody leaves and comes this way.
It's not true. You're going the opposite direction. Drew. The weather is mild down there. Thunderstorms once a day. It's beautiful.
All right.
It doesn't get hotter than 90 degrees down there.
You take the boys fishing again this year?
Oh, maybe. We'll see.
We'll see. Did they enjoy it last time?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
That was a good thing.
All right. Who's with us tonight, Tommaso?
Well, I'm excited. We've got an interview tonight. We've read a book called Going Public, My Adventures Inside the SEC and How to Prevent the Next Devastating Crisis. So particularly interesting to us. So we're going to be excited to talk to Norm Champ. And he is the former director of investment management at the SEC. He also headed up what they call Exam. He was there for a 5-year stint, and now he's a partner in the investment funds group of the law firm Kirkland & Ellis, teaches investment management at Harvard Law School, and he did a lot of great things at the SEC based on all of his book. He went through the money market reform, and he's got some great ideas about how to improve things in the industry. So we're excited. He lives up in New York, my old stomping grounds, with his wife and 4 kids.
Yep. Norm, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah.
Norm, we're SEC advisors, so we've been audited 4 times in the last 27 years, so we appreciate the work that the SEC is doing. It's important because this organization, the Securities and Exchange Commission, is the one, the watchdog for the private investor to prevent, abuse. Investment abuse is that the general gist of what the SEC is all about?
Well, that is definitely true. But remember that the SEC has a 3-part mission. So protecting investors that you're alluding to, right? And that is certainly keeping an eye on advisors and brokers, security exchanges, all the regulated entities, making sure they're not doing anything against the law. But the SEC does have 2 other missions. So maintaining fair and orderly markets, and also facilitating capital formation in the U.S. So it is, it is 3 parts. After the crisis, most of the emphasis has been on protecting investors. Now that we're through kind of the post-crisis period, I think you'll see the commission focus a little more now on capital formation and getting markets, and strengthening U.S. markets.
So in the beginning, though, of the SEC, the focus was on, new capital formation, new stock formations and so forth, because before the Great Depression, anything went.
No question. And so we had 4 statutes get passed after the Great Depression, 33 Act, 34 Act, and the 240 Act. And the SEC was created in 1934, certainly as the investor's watchdog, but also, like you say, to bring some order to how our market's going to function, how we're going to raise capital in the U.S. And really, has, those markets been a tremendous driver of U.S. growth since that time, right? The fact that our markets are so deep and so strong. U.S. markets have been a factor in U.S. growth for 240 years, but really since the Securities and Exchange Commission came along, U.S. markets are the leader all around the world.
So, Norm, you here you are, I believe you said he was a lawyer,
mm-hmm,
right? So
sure.
I'm not going to hold that against you. My brother and father are all lawyers, too. So, here you are. You think 25 years, you got this legal degree, you've got all this financial background. You get this opportunity to go to the SEC. You got this altruistic idea of you're going to go in there and help, da, 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 da. And that wasn't necessarily what you found when you got there.
Totally true. And, it's interesting because a lot of people who write about change and organizational management and stuff, I learned afterwards, it's actually pretty natural that when an organization has big failures, it's actually not that open to change, right? It mostly shrinks in on itself and tries to protect itself. And so I went in thinking, here, I'll bring all this expertise in. But, you get there and you find that people are pretty set in their ways. They've been doing things the same way a long time. And the failures of Bernie Madoff, you know, not finding Bernie Madoff despite multiple exams, not figuring out Alan Stanford despite multiple exams, and, you know, that those two together, $70 billion of investor money down the drain, those failures are so dramatic and so huge that people do tend to get very defensive. And so we did find a real resistance to change. And there are some factors, some cultural factors in the federal government that make it very resistant to change. And I think you're seeing that now with the administration, right, and all the leaks coming out and all the different things happening. Change is not very comfortable ever. And it's particularly uncomfortable in some place like the federal government where people are not subject to being fired. They don't get real monetary rewards either, so they just kind of go along, and change is not natural. So we did meet some resistance.
Stanford was something that hit our local town, right, Tom?
Yeah. I mean, I knew some guys that had gone there and shortly thereafter were raided and closed down, you know, and so that hit right here in Baltimore, and I know that happened. And, you know, Norm, I want to thank you for the, you know, for the work and your service. You know, I was moved by some of the things you wrote in the book and how you brought people back, including the Stanford whistleblower, Julie Pruitt, you know, and bringing her back to a positive stature. You know.
No, it's, you know, Stanford really, and the tragedies of the SEC in some ways is worse than Madoff, because the examiners, I think 10, 12 years before he was caught, examiners wrote wrote a report saying this guy's running a Ponzi scheme.
Mm-hmm.
But they couldn't get anyone in enforcement to take it seriously and investigate, and really billions of dollars of investor money lost from the time they identified as a Ponzi scheme till the time he was arrested. And that's very tough. And so, yeah, we were able to, Julie had been one of the people who spotted, his fraud, and so we were able to bring her back and rehabilitate her and get her back into a productive position.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we got to take our first pause here, Norm, but we'll be back to talk more about what's going on at the SEC and how things are changing for the better of investors in the United States. But right now, I've got to go to traffic. We'll be right back. Money. Personal finance has become a major area of stress due to the increasing dangers and complexities of the global economy. Personal financial management is a comprehensive approach to combating these issues, and the financial physical is the first step. This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate, an independent fee-only firm. The financial physical begins with an objective analysis of your personal finances and ends with a plan to help achieve your goals. Experience the difference of the financial physical and learn how personal financial management can revolutionize your financial well-being. To learn more about the financial physical and the other services we offer, call us at 410-823-SAVE. That's 410-823-7283. Or the easy way to remember that, 410-823-SAVE. Or visit us online at DrewTig.com. That's DrewTig.com. I guess this is for Norm.
That's right. He shook it up.
Shook
up the SEC.
Shook the SEC up, you know. So, Norm. You get to the SEC and you get a letter, an anonymous letter, which mm-hmm. basically is about somebody else or something, you know, if I understood it correctly. Do you have it, Tom?
Well, I mean, there seemed like there were a few of them, a lot of anonymous, you know, attacks going
seems
on
like
there.
They just send anonymous letters, and every time they do, you have a law that says you have to investigate them and so forth. So it wastes a lot of time in the SEC. That was discouraging.
Yeah, it really is tough, and it's a, you know, I'm a big believer that it's not so much bad people as it is bad systems, and I'm afraid that a lot of these things we've set up in the federal government, you know, it's a tough system, right? Because people, they don't really have an upside, don't get to get paid, you know, to the upside, get bonuses, and they can't be fired. So, unfortunately, other things take over, right? And so these notes are used to kind of advance other agendas and to defeat change, like we were talking about earlier. So, yeah, my second week, you know, plain buff envelope delivered, you know, a typed address with your name on it, and it was an anonymous note attacking my predecessor, accusing him of all sorts of terrible things. And he was a guy I'd known for years, and I'm highly confident that he wasn't guilty of any of those things. But they, you know, they delivered it up to me in my second week, and it was clearly a warning saying, look, you get out of line, try to change anything, you're going to be subject to a lot of these notes. And, you know, I had a few over the years, over the 5 years, just like everyone else, but I think it was more discouraging when I saw them, when they used them against people, you know, other people. So, yes, I would have to investigate them. So if they sent a note accusing somebody of something, then we'd have to go out and look into it and check it out, mainly fearful that if we didn't, then the Inspector General or the press or Congress or someone says, how come you didn't look into it? So it's a big time waster. They use it to distract management. You know, disgruntled employees use it to distract management time.
One other thing that was interesting when you first get there is you come into this, what, big, beautiful, almost brand-new building, if I'm not mistaken, and it's dark.
Yeah, we, you know, the urban legend is that the SEC ran out, the government ran out of, you know, ran over budget, and so the lighting got cut, you know, and they had less lighting. I don't know if it was true or not, but it was dark in there, and we sort of look around, and you think, oh, man, this is not good. But a lot of people work from home and everything, so you don't necessarily need that much light in the office. You know, people are out. There's a very generous telework programs, and so.
Well, that brings up another topic. You say telework is absolute waste of time, almost. I mean, that's my words. That's not necessarily your words, but it seemed as if you were saying, "Why do we do this?"
It's a tough one. I mean, look, as I say in the book, I'm not a telework grump. I mean, look, I think occasionally we could all work from home, you know, a day here, a day there. You have personal things, you have things going on. It's a, you know, it's a nice thing to have. But when you have the public employees union and you have them constantly having to improve benefits over and over, right? Every contract has to be better. So what becomes one day of work, a week of telework, then it's two, then it's three. Now they're up to where people can work 5 days a week from home. And I really think we could all acknowledge that, you know, people being home 5 days a week, pretty tough for them to be part of the team and be plugged into what's happening. I noticed, I don't know if you saw this, but IBM, in the last couple months, they're pulling way back. They were one of the leaders on this telework stuff because they're a tech company, and they're pulling way back on all the telework stuff, and they're saying, look, productivity is down. And I think productivity is hard when people are home every day. It's you know, it's tough.
Well, you had one person didn't come to work for, what, 4 years or something like that? You know.
Yeah. That's, yep. No, that we.
That was unique.
That was unique. We got there, and, you know, they came in one day, and they came in and said, oh, we're going to give so-and-so the standard raise. And we were like, who's so-and-so? You know, oh, well, he didn't come in. Well, so anyway, we got after that one, and we did get that one fixed.
But you worked with good people. I mean, you even worked with a good Italian guy, Carlo Di Florio.
My youngest son's
name is Carlo, so that's a good name. But, you know, you did a lot of great things, Norm. And, you know, why don't you pick on, you know, what's one thing you would point out that you really said, you know, this is a great thing that we did while I was there?
So something we did while we were there that I think is really top of the list, it doesn't sound that sexy, but, you know, we put in place manuals of how to operate the investment management division and how to operate the exam division. And, again, that doesn't sound that dramatic, but when you think about Madoff and Stanford and you think about the breakdown in process that led them to miss Madoff and Stanford, getting a manual in place, I'm sure you guys said you're in the business. I'm sure you have a manual about your business and compliance, but there were no manuals at the SEC. You know, they didn't have anything written down. And that's why people could go and examine Madoff, but never check his trades. They examined him multiple times, but they never, you know, he's supposedly doing this trading strategy. They never verified it. Stanford, you know, supposedly investing in these CDs in Antigua, they never verified that. And they didn't escalate it when they found fraud. So we put in place procedures to make sure that, boy, if you go out and examine somebody, you make sure they're real, you check their trades. And two, if you find fraud, you escalate it up the ladder, right? And so, honestly, I think having those policies and procedures in place so that 5 years from now, when people don't even remember Madoff and Stanford, somebody's got some real process so that they can avoid the mistakes of Madoff and Stanford.
So, Norm, when, as I said, I had four audits, and the first three were between 1990 and 2006, and it was always two people. Two people came in. Just 6 months ago, 8 months ago, we had our last audit, and four people came in, and they all had seemed like a different function. Is that something that you had to do with?
Well, you may have gotten more people. One thing they're definitely doing is they are bringing enforcement people out on examinations in order to kind of educate them about what's going on out there, and they work much more closely. One of the things we definitely accomplished was the examiners, like the ones who are coming to visit you, they work much more closely with enforcement these days, so that if you got something like Stanford where people think, you know, they identify as a fraud, enforcement can be involved very early on to judge whether they can prove it, that kind of stuff. That wasn't how it worked, and so you could have had that, could have had somebody from enforcement coming in with could be someone also from one of the like investment management who's coming along to help out and look at, you know, what you're doing and learn about firms. So the, I would say yes, generally bigger teams. They never go below two, just for personal security reasons. You know, they don't want to send one person out somewhere in case, you know, there's some problem. So, but you know, I would say yes, they are working more broadly across the agency now than they did before.
What year did you start?
I started in January of 2010. So about
January of 2010. But yep. Now you talk about the breaking of the buck of
the money market.
The reserve primary fund. Mm-hmm. And I thought the way you talked about it in the book, it seemed as if you were involved with that at that time.
No, I was. I got there afterwards. So I got there about a year after reserve primary. But I had the same, you know, I had the job of the person who was there when it did go down, right? And so it was very clear that we didn't have the information, you know, when the crisis happened and when reserve primary happened. SEC just didn't have the data and the information about money market funds that it needed in a crisis like that. And so it, you know, first thing the SEC did was get more data about money market funds. So that was step one. And then step two was we had to get through a reform process and come up with a way to reform those funds to try to prevent them from collapsing again. So I was involved in the whole reform effort, which took 2 full years to get done.
Now, it's funny, you know, that it took them that long, you know, because in 1986 or 87, I was with Raymond James and Associates, and Mortgage Realty Corp. went under, and the short-term paper was bought back by Raymond James and T. Rowe Price and a couple others to not have to break the buck. It's the first time I'd ever heard it. I'm like, you know, whoa, what are they doing? You know, you tell me that. And I started to realize, I said, wow, I'm never going to invest in a corporate money market fund from this day forward. I'm always going to buy a government guaranteed, because my money market fund was just for liquid, you know, emergency cash as we're investing, moving money back and forth. I don't want to worry about if Raymond James is going to bail it out, or T. Rowe Price or Prudential or anyone else. I just want to know it's there. And I stopped investing in it in 1987.
Exactly. And that was the, you know, two pieces of that. Number one, those big firms did bail out some of their funds. The problem with reserve primary was the manager of the funds didn't have the capital to bail them out.
Of course.
Because, you know, they were holding Lehman Brothers paper worth $682 million, so there was no bailing that out, right? So that number one, they were a manager who didn't have that kind of capital. Number two, what you're referencing, though, is like these funds go back, exactly, they go back more than 30 years, and frankly, they were a mistake from the beginning, right? Because,
yep,
like you say, they're where people put money in between trades, you know, it's almost bank account-like. And foolishly, the commission back then said, if you put a dollar in, you get a dollar back, you know, and that's a bank account, not a securities account.
Sure.
And so, you know, they were a mistake from the start.
All right, Norm, you got to hold with us one more traffic break, and we're going to be right back. We're going to go into what's happening new in the SEC when we get back. But right now, we got to go to traffic. Be right back. Money, riches, and wealth.
75% of adults agree they could benefit from advice and answers to everyday financial questions from a professional. This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consult. We strive to serve as a leader in educating the public on personal finance topics through our Financial Pulse and Consulate Journal. For these publications and learn about our personal financial management services, visit our website at drewtig.com, drewtig.com, and follow us on Twitter at the FinCon for educational updates.
We're back, Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're here with Norm Champ and his book, Going Public, Inside the SEC, and what was his experience there and the things that happened to help to regulate the securities industry and protect investors and the in the markets, et cetera, et cetera. So, Norm, a few things have changed over the last 6-7 years since you were at the SEC. I mean, you left in 2014, but things have happened. So you had the Dodd-Frank and the FOSC.
FSOC, uh-huh.
FSOC, Financial
Stability Oversight Council. Is that right, Norm?
Yep, exactly.
FSOC there, right? And neither of those that I think is government, you know, government at its finest. I don't mean that as a compliment. And then the Volcker Rule, which I don't believe has actually ever been implemented.
Oh, it has.
Has it?
Yep.
Did it get?
Yeah.
Okay. So tell us about, you know, one at a time, what's going on with them. What do you think of them? Do you think they were good, or is it, you know, what is your take?
So I totally agree with you. Dodd-Frank, obviously 2010, Dodd-Frank is not government at its finest. I think, you know, even somebody like the Treasury Secretary, you know, Tim Geithner in his book, you know, says that Dodd-Frank got loaded up like a Christmas tree, right? Dodd-Frank, about 80% of Dodd-Frank doesn't have anything to do with the crisis, right? There were all these different things that people had saved up over the years, and they got added to that bill. And so there are a couple things in there that relate to the crisis, sort of, you know, getting derivatives to trade more publicly to try to avoid like an AIG type deal, a couple other things, but generally it's a lot of stuff that was wish list kind of things that didn't have anything to do with the crisis and are really not doing much to make Americans safer. One of those things is this Financial Stability Oversight Council. So Dodd-Frank creates a Financial Stability Oversight Council, 10 federal regulators. You know, guys, there's very few things you can predict confidently, but you know, our record in human history of government predicting a economic crisis and stopping it, I think we're zero for 9,000 years or however long back we know of human history. You know, government is not going to predict the next crisis and head it off. It's just not going to happen. And the Financial Stability Oversight Council is another example of that. It's supposed to look for systemically risky firms or risks in the system, but really, you know, it's a way to expand government control over banks, insurance companies. And while I was at the SEC, they tried to expand it over asset managers like you guys. We were able to hold them off with a lot of data we had about the industry and a lot of additional rules we passed to make sure that Financial Stability Oversight Council did not take over regulating asset management. But I call it in the book a Frankensteinish creature out to roam the world. And I have to say, you know, a real disappointment in the new administration is that the Treasury Secretary and his response to the President's, you know, request to review financial regulation, Treasury Secretary says they're going to keep the Financial Stability Oversight Council and have it monitor risk, and I just think that's a bad idea. One thing I argue in the book is that the Financial Stability Oversight Council should be gotten rid of, but doesn't look like that's going to happen this time around. Volcker Rule was indeed implemented, and
what exactly is the Volcker Rule?
Yep. So I don't want to, you know, be careful here. I don't want to put your listeners to sleep, but we two pieces to the Volcker Rule. One is saying that one piece of it basically saying that banks cannot put government insured money, so the money that insures people's deposits, banks can't put in government insured money at risk, right, other than normal kind of activity. So the idea of that part of the Volcker Rule is that banks shouldn't be able to bet on securities using money that the FDIC has insured, you know, federal banking deposits. The second part of Volcker is to further that principle and to say also banks shouldn't be able to take, except in small amounts, shouldn't be able to take insured money and put it into private funds, so hedge funds, private equity funds, that kind of stuff. It's all an attempt to draw a line. The simplest way to think about Volcker, it's an attempt to draw a line between traditional banking activities, right? Just putting money in the bank, they lend it out for mortgages, you know, very sort of plain vanilla banking, and investment banking. So helping companies do deals, helping companies issue securities. As your audience, I'm sure, knows, those two kinds of banking activities were separated by something called Glass-Steagall, repealed during the Clinton years, and now that banks can do both, They can do traditional banking activities and investment banking activities. Congress thought that that was too much in one place, and the Volcker Rule really tries to split those activities without splitting banks and investment banks back out again. So it's a, like a half measure. It tries to split the activities of insured deposit taking and risk taking without going back to Glass-Steagall, where the bank had to be separate from the investment bank.
Now, you know, I would agree with that. I feel that any deposits that the government is guaranteeing, no company should be able to use those in essence to, you know, invest in risky things like many of the brokerage firms did.
And actually, I don't disagree with you. So in general, I'm not a big fan of Dodd-Frank, as you can tell. I don't disagree with you that, and I think probably all of us would agree, that depositor money, you know, insured deposit money should not be used for risk-taking. And I think we'd probably get a consensus around that. I guess where I do differ with what was done is, you know, they did it through the 1,000-page Volcker Rule, which means lots of Federal Reserve regulators running around banks trying to enforce it, basically using their judgment and kind of making it up as they go along about what they see as risky or what they don't see as risky. What I would have preferred was just go back to Glass-Steagall. You know, let's just go back, split it out into two entities, let one, you know, do traditional banking, let one do investment banking, let the chips fall where they may. I don't like the Volcker Rule because it kept them together but tried to draw this line, and it's basically a government. It's a regulator's dream, you know, more regulators, more supervision, more discretion. I'm not a big fan of that. So I would have liked to see it split out, but I agree.
I would agree with you wholeheartedly. I would rather see Glass-Steagall, too. Just to be a bank is a bank. You lend money, and that's all there is to it. No more risk-taking, period. We're going to insure your deposits. That's it. Simple. Mm-hmm. Straightforward. Anybody who wants to take more risk, they should be able to understand you know, that I'm investing with somebody who's not insuring my deposits.
Right,
end
right.
of the story.
For sure.
You know?
Now, Norm, I mean, you've gone through this crisis as we have. You know, when you talk to family and friends, what kind of advice do you give them? What advice do you give to the listeners out there as they're working with advisors? What do you tell them to look for and to avoid? And what kinds of things do you tell people?
So great question. And, you know, kind of topic of my next book. So I'm working on the next one about... You know, I'm really focused on people's individual balance sheets and trying to, you know, I'm writing the next book about really, I call it kind of retail, you know, financial management, like each of us managing our own balance sheet. Because, as I mentioned, I don't see government heading off the next crisis. I just don't think it's realistic. And I think the best hope is for people to think about their own balance sheets and think about how they can weather the next crisis, right? So, to your question, my first thing is, you know, we live in a society that promotes consumerism and getting people to spend, right? First thing is people got to get spending under control, make sure that they're not going down, you know, don't need the fifth big screen TV, that kind of stuff. Second thing, get those expenses under income, right, so they get to the positive point. And then I'm, you know, I don't think anybody should be going out to advisors until they have a decent net worth, right? So you shouldn't be going out looking for anything beyond plain old vanilla mutual funds until you have, I don't know, call the number, but 250 grand, 400 grand, some kind of net worth, right, where beyond that, then I think it's important to look, you know, for more advice and thinking about how to diversify. But what kills me is we don't really focus on the basic blocking and tackling of financial health for people in this country. You know, very little financial education, nothing in the high schools, nothing in colleges. And I'd like to see people start that savings earlier, 401ks, tax-free accounts, those kind of things, right when they start working, so that they can start to build up that net worth to get to the point where then they're shopping for advisors and looking for more help.
Norm, you got to hold with us again. We have to take our last pause of the evening, and we'll come back and look at some of those other things that you're recommending to help our country prevent the next financial crisis. But right now, we have to take traffic pause. We'll be right back. Money, Richard, and West. I'm not sure how Layla lines up with this, but anyway, it's always a good old song, you know. Anyway, we're here with Norm Champ, and Norm, you have a website of some sort, right, that people can go to get more information about yourself?
Absolutely, normchamp.com, and we've got, you know, a log there of different press coverage, book reviews, those kinds of things. It links to a book website, and then also has a calendar of, you know, appearances and book signings and those kinds of things.
How did you come up with the name for that website?
You know, it had a contest, you know, and I was able to, you know, triumph over Bodie McBoatface or whatever.
I guess a better question is, how did you manage to get Norm Champ? You figure that would somebody else might have had that, you know, by then. Anyway, one of the things I loved about your topics on how to change the financial, prevent a financial crisis, and I said this many times to people in the 2008 crisis, I said, you know, one of the best ways we could have prevented 2008 was had real professional financial advisors telling people that you're going to be kidding buying these houses for the prices and writing notes to people and telling them, you know, I'll pay you 20% more than you're listing your house for. I did that numerous times during the 2006 and 2000. I even sold my own house. I was so enthralled with how much money people were willing to pay me for it. And you say, this is what you say, stop government selling lottery tickets and sponsored gambling to people and ripping off Americans in these gambling things that government is sponsoring, and use the money that they do for all the advertising they do and so forth to promote financial literacy. I think it's a great idea.
Thanks so much, and I have to say I feel so strongly about it. It's just a real shame. I think I say in the book, you know, if we're going to nominate people for the Government Hall of Shame, it's got to be the lottery, right? Because exactly, not only is the government promoting housing relentlessly, right? So keeping interest rates low, guaranteeing mortgages, the whole thing. So getting people to buy homes, Congress pre-crisis mandated home loans to lower income Americans. You know, it all sounds great. But boy, if we interviewed those people that were foreclosed on in 2009, 2010, imagine how they feel. At the same time, the government relentlessly promotes the worst investment in human history, which is the lottery. The lottery in America is a monopoly. They give out about 55% of what they take in. The casinos are bad enough, but they give out about 85%, right? They have a 15% margin. Lottery has a 45% margin because it's a monopoly. What do they care? And as I talk about in the book, in New York, where I live, low-income New Yorkers spend about 10% of their income on lottery tickets. It's just a tragedy. It's a tax those folks don't have to pay. If they took that money, you guys are financial advisors, you took that 10% of their income, instead of putting in lottery tickets, put it into tax-free accounts like IRAs or 401ks, get even a decent modicum of management to have a decent stocks, bonds mix. And those folks, that, you know, before you know it, they're going to have significant net worth, and they'll be able to weather a downturn. Or you guys have seen, I'm sure your listeners have seen the stats. Most people say they don't have $400 for a car repair, you know, don't have $2,000 in the bank. It's just a simple step, like stopping the government from advertising the lottery, putting that money into tax-free accounts that can get some decent management, just transformative for America if we can get that, you know, if we can get that out there. So I've spent a lot of time promoting that, a lot of time trying to get people not to play the lottery. It's just the worst. It's just terrible. And the fact that government promotes it and government takes that's a tax. It's regressive. You know, that mm-hmm. hits the poor. If you, yeah. you know, if people who have some net worth go out and buy a lottery ticket occasionally when it's $400 million jackpot, no big deal. But if you're talking about somebody making 20 grand a year, that's a big deal to have them going out and spending 10% of their income on lottery tickets. Just a national shame, real shame.
So I'm going to, you know, this is our bias, okay? So I'm going to ask you a question, Norm, and that is our bias. And, you know, we, in 1995, our firm became fee-only, independent fiduciaries 100% of the time. We refuse to take commissions. We refuse to take referral fees. We want everybody in the firm to be as credentialed as they possibly can be and educated and experienced in financial advice before they start working with clients and so forth. And that's our opinion. And I think that the financial advice industry is incredibly confusing to the public. And it's a disgrace that our country hasn't done anything to try to help the public understand who's really giving advice out there. What is your take on that? Now, you know, you can give me your honest opinion, because that's our opinion.
No, I hear you, and I think, you know, as we look now at a new Securities and Exchange Commission, a new chair, Jay Clayton, you know, has been in about a month now, and you probably saw, you know, one of his first steps was to ask again about making the fiduciary standard apply to everybody who is taking client money. He put out a release asking for comment on that. I'm very hopeful that finally we might get some movement on this issue, because you couldn't be more right as far as the confusion in the American people's minds. I saw it all the time in the work we did at the SEC. You do these surveys. Most people have no idea whether they're dealing with an investment advisor or a broker-dealer, and yet we have two standards for them. Investment advisors have to abide by a fiduciary standard. Broker-dealers by suitability standard.
Even worse, Norm, you got these insurance agents out there selling these annuities, telling them they're giving them bonuses, they're giving them guarantees, they're giving them this, and they're an advisor to them. That's even worse.
We have such a deficit of transparency to the American people about who is selling them what, and why we have not gotten on top of this as a regulatory matter and simply made it a fiduciary standard across everything. Anyone who's an intermediary between the customer, the retail customer, and the markets should be subject to the same standard. And I hope that, you know, I certainly advocate that in the book, that we get, you know, more education out there so people know who they're dealing with. And I'm encouraged that the new chair seems to be focused on this issue. There is no reason that we should have the retail investor confused about who they're dealing with. Why should that be? That's just not, again, it's the same thing as a lottery. Why are we doing these things? Part of what I really try to stress in the book is we've got to learn these things. You know, we're doing these things, they have bad results, and then we go and do them again, right? So one quick example on that. Before the crisis, they lowered the down payment on mortgages to 3%. Mm-hmm. Well, you get that gives you very little margin if market turns against you on your house, right? After the crisis, government raised the minimum down payments to 20% of the home's value. That's a little more reasonable. It gives you a little more safety net. In 2014, you know, barely 6 years after the crisis, the Obama administration pushed that minimum down payment right back down to 3%. You know, and we're back in the same thing with the government getting people into these investments in homes. Not everyone should own a home, right? It's just not, you know, different stages of life. People have different needs. And it's the same thing on the investment side. We've got to have more transparency and got to have a better regulatory regime so that individual Americans can build their balance sheets and be their masters of their own destiny, not worried of, you know, not waiting for the government to do something.
You know, one of the funny things of our investigation that they had about 6 months ago is one of their main focuses was our radio show.
That's
they,
right.
They were really, you know, intent on, you know, listening to every radio show to see what we said and so forth. And after they finished listening to, I don't know, 10, 20 shows or
right.
something like that, they were just, you know, befuddled.
Right.
You know, that
we weren't selling anything.
And our compliance guy was keeping us under control.
I'm sure that the fact you got a radio show, that may be why you got four people. I mean,
they had 10.
They may have gotten it, you know, that probably got their attention. And you know, look, the examiners are trying to do their best. They're trying to get out there and protect investors, and they have a hard job. And, you know, part of what I say in the book, one of the reviews in the book that meant the most to me was, you know, the reviewer said that, you know, Mr. Champ is hard on the failings of government, but, you know, laudatory of the people who are trying to turn the ship around. And, you know, there are a lot of quiet patriots there at the SEC who are doing everything they can to help investors and protect investors and make sure investors aren't getting ripped off. But the process and the system aren't very good, and, you know, their chances of success before the crisis weren't so hot. I think we made it better, but it always needs vigilance because, you know, it's a government agency and they have a hard time keeping up. So, but it sounds like those guys were fascinated by your radio show.
They were. Norm, we're out of time. Amazing. That was a great interview, great topic. NormChamp.com is a way they can stay in touch with you, right?
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Thanks, Norm.
Norm, we really appreciate it. And this is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.